We now turn, I think, to the due process handbook itself. And there are a number of different memos. Richard and Henry, given the time, I would ask you only to...
I'll just whisk through this.
Whisk okay. through them.
Whisk
through them while giving the committee an adequate opportunity to say...
No shortened discussion periods.
But I'm assuming everyone has read them, and so I don't think we need to go through them.
So the paper 1D sets the context for this. I won't go through any of the detail. I'll just remind you of the timetable, which is next steps, paragraph 16. So you have in front of you the proposals and the draft amendments to the handbook. We'll ask you for detailed comments on those draft amendments by the 15th of February. We'll liaise further with you, probably have a public call to discuss the proposals. And then the intention still is to publish the exposure draft of the due process handbook in March or April for 90 days. We have another meeting in June, but we expect that the finalised due process handbook will come back to you with the comment letter analysis in your meeting in October. So that's the timetable. There's no surprises in that, and there's no decisions asked of you on paper 1D. Paper 1E starts to split the decision-making between two groups. So you remember that when it came to you in October, we had a number of proposals. Some of them required some policy decisions, some were easier to address. The policy decisions papers you'll be coming to are papers 1F through to 1H. 1E explains what we've done so far and sets out the proposals for the simpler issues as well as some drafting issues. So specifically, we've explained to you in paragraphs 3 through to 6 the proposals for dealing with the adding issues to the work plan. Paragraph 7 and 8 describe the agenda decisions. Paragraphs 9 and 10 move on to the taxonomy. And then we have the decision papers that follow. At the back of that paper, on page 6, we've set out the minor issues that we've addressed, kept you informed of, but they really are just tidying things up and clarifying, so they're all set out there. So that's the big issue background, and then we move on to the more detailed papers from 1F onwards.
Let me do it this way. Is there any comment question from the committee on the items that are discussed in this first memo or the second memo, other than agenda decisions, effects analysis, or education? Because those three are subject to separate memos, and we can talk about them seriatim as we get there. But there were decisions made at the last meeting or some minor drafting suggestions that are discussed in this second memo. And let me open the floor to any comments or questions about those items, i.e. anything other than agenda decisions, effects analysis, or education. Sheila.
Can I just ask kind of an overall question? One of the issues that came up in the broad consultation was the timeliness of standard setting and how, you know, the whole process around it. And I just, going through all this, I really questioned if anything that is being done here is making the process more timely. And if that impression is correct, and please correct me if that's not right, are there other things coming that will address that? Or
The committee, the board, the foundation took that specific question to the advisory council in September. And the reaction of the advisory council was, I think, surprisingly strong that the actual substance of timing is not an issue. Having taken the outreach and the comments into effect, that correctness of outcomes is more important than timing, and that the solution, the principal solution to the timing issues, don't really involve changes to the framework, but involve A, better communication, and more transparency, and B, perhaps more flexibility where appropriate. But I think the handbook provides for flexibility. I think the last two conversations actually are evidence of that. And so I think where we are, subject to always more thinking about anything, is we've heard loud and clear the issues about timing. We've thought about them. We've consulted with the advisory council about them. And yes, there are things we can do, but they probably don't involve much major by way of changes to the due process handbook. But it's not for lack of having considered the comment.
And I think the advisory council, Ms. Allen, were very much saying we shouldn't be afraid of basically making the point that developing high-quality standards takes that time. That, you know, you require that due process to develop high-quality standards, and we shouldn't be afraid to say so, and perhaps should be clear about that.
You know, we have to move quickly, but one, if you look at the comments, the timing comment is easy in one direction, but there's lots of indirect comment in the other direction. Do a more thorough effects analysis. Be careful about, you know, outreach and setting standards and so forth. So I actually think the comments about timing in their broadest sense go in both directions. And a personal comment, yeah, do I think, you know, we could move faster in some cases? Yes, but I don't think it has to do, not many, because I think, as I said before, correctness trumps speed. But it's not an issue of what's written in the handbook. It's behavioral on all sides. Michelle?
Still alive.
Oh, sorry.
He's seeking. I should. This tells me something, I guess, right? I cannot.
No, I have not pulled the plug. Go ahead.
No, so you're seeking comments at a high level at this stage on the document, and we'll send them separate detailed comments. But I think, you know, on two broad comments. One was this question of timeliness versus quality, and that for me is a very sort of a biased debate, because I don't think, you know, the two are necessarily opposed, you know, and I think it simplifies the issue to put them one against the other. So there is a way to, I think that there could be a way to think about process, you know, with timing in mind and timeliness in mind, without, you know, any sacrifice of quality, but that's a much broader debate. And so I think there is it's a nice idea to, when we read these documents, think about, are we, you know, moving in the right direction or the opposite direction in terms of, you know, speed and timeliness.
Yeah. I think that point is well taken. I think it's outside the context of the handbook to a large extent, because, I mean, the internal time is mostly time spent, and I would say in the vast majority of cases, time well spent in deliberating either on information received from the outside or information developed on the inside. And having the board think about its procedures in the context of what it's trying to accomplish is, it's, I think, a fair point. It's not a due process handbook point. Mm. I mean, in terms of the handbook, the largest timing issues are, frankly, the requirements of, I'm sorry, the preference for the progression from research to work to standards. I'm loath to say that it's not a good idea to have a research phase first. Mm. It's the progression from discussion paper to exposure draft to, I'm sorry, discussion paper, discussion paper, discussion draft to exposure draft or concept. There's a three-step process which can be reduced to two steps, culminating in an exposure draft. I'm loath to say that there should be, as a matter of course, one less step. And the comment period. And in all candor, do I, you know, this is Alan Beller speaking. That's has nothing to do with the DPOC. Do I think people need 120 days to comment about even the most complicated standards? No. Because I think with given a 120-day comment period, I know the way comment letters work. I used to write them. If there's a 120-day comment period, the document sits on your desk for 60 days. But I think we have an obligation to give the largest possible opportunity for comment by the largest number of stakeholders. And so I'm loath to say that the rule of 120, we ought to think about making it 90. And it's only that's only 30 days anyway. So big picture, I think the largest issues are actually not the ones in the handbook, but the ones sort of, as I said, behavioral on all sides. We can, and I think if we want to talk about that, I'm happy to talk about it, but I think it's outside the context of the handbook.
And the second point, very minor. I think when we first discussed this a year ago, there was a, you know, when we, as a new trustee, we came in, and I think the document itself was very difficult to use, basically. I think there was an idea to try to make it user-friendly, and including identifying for trustees, what are you supposed to do? And is that happening? Or?
Well, the handbook for trustees is, I think, a separate question. And the answer is we've kind of done that. The changes are not substantive, and so we've not spent a lot of time talking about them. But you will see some... You will see that there will be some proposed changes that are organizational, that are an attempt to make it easier to use.
And Michelle, also perhaps just to add that I think one of the things we're doing is that some of our thinking about that organizational change to try and accommodate more and actually simplify materials that sort of, you know, flowcharts explaining the due process and like separate to the handbook as a better communication exercise. So we're thinking that's a way to really address that.
I think a good idea, which we should talk about in due course, is maybe some educational material around the handbook, which flowcharts, outlines, so forth, that make it easier to use. As I say, I think we'll make some at least modest changes in organization that will be completely non-substantive, but I think helpful in usability. Teresa?
Thank you, Alan. For a due process committee, when you have an area of responsibility deleted in its entirety, you kind of like pause and think. And so I just have an observation and a question. The first observation is that as a result of the change of the nature of the IFRS Advisory Council, becoming more strategic than technical consultative, I noticed that it has been the monitoring of the effectiveness of that council has been taken out of our remit. So we have one less thing to kind of look at. But then I noticed that the comment is that then comes the responsibility of the general trustees to monitor the effectiveness of that council. So the question I have is where does that, is it just general kind of follow on reporting that we get and the board, what is that process?
I think the removal,
which is probably not our responsibility, I just want to raise it.
I think the removal of that set of that line, which will be more evident in the as we move forward. This is actually a reaction to what we've been hearing from the committee in the last several months, starting in whenever a meeting, I guess, Hong Kong. With respect to some of our oversight functions, for example, the due process oversight of standard setting itself, And I think the conversation we've been having for the last hour plus is ample evidence that we actually dig into what the board and the staff tell us in their various reports about the due process that has gone around the standard setting process. Even there, the members of the committee can sit in as observers to IFRIC meetings, can sit in as observers to board meetings, can sit in as observers sort of any of the standard setting processes and maintenance processes we have. We are very much limited to that which we are told. And so I think one of our principal oversight responsibilities is to be sure we ask for what we think we need to fulfill our responsibilities. And for example, we have over the last several meetings evolved to a place where we're asking the staff to make affirmative representations to us about their consideration as to whether due process has been followed. While we may make our own observations there or conclusions, they are very much informed by what the staff and the board tells us. There are other situations, and frankly, the advisory council falls into this second category, where we really have essentially no information other than that which the board and the staff tell us. And so to ask us to reach a conclusion that the advisory council has done X, Y, or Z is to ask us to say nothing more than we can read what the staff has brought to us. That amendment is frankly just more in the nature of conforming the handbook to reality than saying anything new and different.
Thank you, Alan. I think I'm fine to exclude it from the responsibility of this particular committee, but as every single one of us are also trustee of the foundation, and it suggests that the monitoring of the council has become the responsibility of the general trustee. My question, which I'm not very well, is how do we monitor? How do we do the monitoring?
That is not the intent, Lee.
I'm not sure about the term monitoring, but certainly there is clear intent that we want to get a closer alignment between the advisory council, the conversations that are happening there, and back to the general trustees, not to this committee. So that is a bit of work in progress for us, Teresa, as we work up as they've reshaped themselves. We've got a couple of examples in our trustee agenda around that, and certainly we will have the chair of the advisory council in attendance. So I think that's something that we can build on that foundation to do that a bit further. And I think we need to consider what monitoring at a trustee level really means.
Thank you. It's a work in progress, isn't it? I mean, I think, yes, okay. And then probably something that we would need to be taken up with the new chair as well. I think it's just that because we heard earlier that there is sort of reporting back to the board from the discussion of the council, and obviously we take, you know, the views of the council quite seriously as well. So, you know, I think from a process point of view, I think there's got to be some protocol, which if we take it out of this committee, which I'm fine. Maybe, I don't know, maybe what is the link? It's fine. It seems to me that it's something we need to think about.
Agreed, and I think we can take this forward out of this committee to our discussion in the next day or so with Joanna as well as the chair.
I agree with that. The conversation we had earlier, I mean, the reporting line from the advisory council to the trustees as well as the board is, I think, an important thing to think about. This change to the handbook really addresses a slightly different point, which is the Due Process Oversight Committee responsible for, in effect, saying the Advisory Council is doing its job or the Advisory Council is not doing its job and we need to do A, B, or C? I honestly don't think that the committee has access to enough information to be asked to be responsible for that function, and the change is in that narrow area, not what Lee and you have been talking about, with which I completely agree. Anything else, or
are you referring to
Larry?
Anything else in one in all the papers 1D through H?
Sorry? Anything else that you should be aware of, or
no? Yeah, we're only on 1E. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, agenda decisions, effect analysis, education is F, G, and H, I think. Okay. Shall we move on to F, which is agenda decisions?